Oh, mais מה, השמש?
לא, זה יפה, השיער שלך כזה נוצץ מהשני.
זה לא יפה? זה לא... אחרי כל החורף של... שחסר לנו שמש, אני ממש שמח אם יש קצת. So the subject is Satipatthana as a way of, as a path to liberation. And the word Satipatthana is from the Pali language, which is the language of the traditional Buddhist text of 2,500 years ago. And it means foundations for mindfulness. And why it's an important text is in the 10,000 or so texts that we have from the Buddhist canon of the ancient Buddhist teachings, this particular one is only one in 10,000, but it's nevertheless regarded as being the major teaching for the Theravada, Vipassana, mindfulness tradition in the, as it's come to the West. So that's this particular text has, in a way, the authority text for the whole mindfulness movement in the West. Sati is the Pali word for mindfulness, and Patthana is the Pali word for the foundations, the ground, or the base of mindfulness. And are you okay so far with the English? You're all right? Are you sure? Okay. So I'm making it as clear and not complicated language. The text and the whole concept of mindfulness comes out of a deep understanding that we can't think ourselves to liberation. That we can have thoughts about liberation, we can have desire for liberation. But we live in a very constructed world. That we are the result of construction. We are built. Our consciousness is built. Our brain is got networks already engraved because they're mastulim. It's already there. We are constructed beings. And thought is another construction. And so we need other tools to liberate ourselves from within a constructed world. We need something else other than thought. And like Einstein once said, you can't solve problems with the same mind that created them. And sati, mindfulness, is another way of using the mind that doesn't need thought. It doesn't need construction. It's deconstructing. What the Pali language sati means, remembering to be aware. And that's not in exactly in the English translation mindfulness, which is the translation of sati, because sati in the Pali has this element of remembering to be aware. And it's a understanding that we will forget. And it's happened to all of us all the time. You listen to a word of instruction from myself, come to the breath, and after 2 minutes, whoop, the thoughts arrive and take us on a journey to Haifa, to our childhood, to what's going to happen tomorrow, to the telephone call I should make and I didn't make, to the cup of coffee that I wanted now, and we're gone. And then we come back. So it's an acknowledgement that we need to remember to be aware. And that's sati. So it has the old English word recollection. But don't worry about it. it's to recollect, to collect ourselves again here. That's another way of describing it. To gather ourselves here into the present.
To remember
to be aware. I mean, that's the... And it has many, many, many levels. It's a hugely rich field. Because you can say, well, we have the power of attention, and the attention applied to walking brings us to be more aware and a bit more connected to our life. And that's fine, and that's part of it. And I'm just talking to you about use in therapy, to remember to be aware in therapy, to help someone to be aware of what's really going on with them. So it has a sense of reconnecting us with the world instead of disconnecting from the world into our commentary or abstraction. But it goes much, much deeper than that, and it goes into a deeply spiritual place, which in the Theravada tradition is called the deathless, that is, you would say, nitzchi, eternal, has no death, no birth and no death. And the reason is that deep, deep sense of mindfulness, there is only the present moment, which is constantly changing. And there's no place where you can say, this is the end, this is the beginning, this is I'm born, this I die. It's just a field of present moment awareness. So it goes into the deepest place of awakened state of being in the present. Timeless, the timeless now, you could say. So we're just reading a quote from Wittgenstein that said he discovered that eternity really means the experience of being timeless, and therefore in the present moment there is no death. And Wittgenstein is a great Buddhist. But it's that kind of sense of beyond the boundaries and beyond the conventional view of this is beginning and this is the end and so on. Now, mindfulness also has in it a sense of taking charge or taking responsibility for our own minds. And this is not in the word itself, but in the application, not in sati, but in the way sati is described in the Satipatthana Sutta. It's taking charge of our mind. Instead of our mind controlling us, we are master in a way of our mind. Our mind becomes a servant, or becomes one of the many activities of the living being. And we're in a sense take responsibility for it, we're in charge of it. And there's another aspect of this which is called sampayana. And sampayana is not only do we have attention, but we have wise attention. And that's not always so understood in the Western world, because mindfulness has often been taken to a place very much called bare attention without commentary or chains of processing. Sampayana, sampajana. Sampajana, S-A-M-P-A-J-A-N-N-A. Sampajana. Doesn't matter, the Pali, it's not important. I can send you the Hebrew translation of Satipatthana Sutta. I mean, I can send you tons of stuff, but I don't know who to send it to, so I didn't send anything. But, you know, if you want, I can. Maybe it's a nice thing to send, I can send you this in English and Hebrew. Maybe you send me a mail, and then I'll send it to you, and you can send it. Great.
Can you please repeat this?
Sampajana. So what it means... Yeah, I'm just going to say this. Sampajana is wise attention. Now, take the example of a burglar, Ganav. He's very mindful. He goes into a house. He's very watchful. He doesn't want to be heard. So he's very careful. He probably watches every step he takes, and he steals everything, and he goes out. Is this mindfulness? Yes, it's mindfulness, but it's not wise. It is not a way to awakening.
It's wise for him.
It's not even wise for him. He's setting up karma, problems, issues for him, issues for everybody else, more suffering in life, also for him, also for others. It's on a track that's not wise. And so there is a concept, and a very important concept in Buddhist teaching altogether, which is nutrition, hasana. In fact, you will not find anywhere in the whole 10,000 Buddhist text anything called right or wrong. You will not find it right, evil, you will not find the word evil in the Buddhist text at all. But you'll find those actions, thoughts, etc. that are nutrition, wholesome, in English, bring food, hasana, bring food to the soul, or the opposite. Don't feed, take away. And this concept of nutrition, what is healthy, is very much all through the spiritual tradition of Buddhism. And so it's not just bare attention, it's also attention on what is good for us, what is helpful for us, what makes harmony, what cleans karma, what cleans damage, what feeds the good part of us. So it's not neutral, it has value. It has values. Okay, and that's in really written in this particular text, but also all the others too. Nutritional attitude is an important issue.
Can I ask?
Yeah, of course.
You talked about liberation from the thoughts, from our thoughts, from thinking?
Not liberation from the control of the thoughts, because thinking, there's nothing wrong with thinking. We need thoughts, and they just come and they go and they do their job. But instead of being controlled by them, there are for us a useful servant. We need to, now I'm using language, I need thoughts, definition, pictures in the mind in order to use language. When I stop using language, I don't need them. So it's thought is not a negative thing at all, but it's seen much more functionally. And of course, I'm going to talk a bit more about this, the thoughts can serve awakening. Instead of being controlling us and having... I'll talk a bit more about this later, but... So we control our thoughts, and we also can help to direct them towards awakening.
About this point of not mentioning evil or bad or etc., there is this contrast between there is the right thing to do, the nutritious thing to do, and being very non-judgmental in the mindfulness. Being non-judgmental is a very important basis for mindfulness.
Absolutely,
How do you connect these opposites?
It's a good question. I think that you can do it through an understanding of what is helpful without the need to beat yourself when you do something not helpful. It's more like the chaven. It's putting ourselves in the direction of what is helpful. But if we find we've done something that's not helpful, we don't beat ourselves about it at all. What someone once told me, didn't understand something.
I said you have to be not Jewish in order not to be
the same. Someone once said, when I was doing a little bit of training to teach in America, and senior teacher got up and said, "You know what it is to be a Dharma teacher, like a Buddhist Dharma teacher, is not to be charismatic and to give them best talk and to entertain and so on. It's if you give the worst talk in your life, you get up and you don't think one more thought about it." So it's kind of judgmental itself is a habit or a tendency or a non-nutritional circle in the mind, and we don't need it in order to direct ourselves towards what is wholesome. Mindfulness is about reconnecting, rejoining the elements moment by moment, genuine experience of this mind body as it meets the world. At every moment we're meeting the world, we're part of the world, so the eyes that see, the ears that hear, the mind that thinks, the tongue that tastes, the senses are all giving us a flow of changing interaction with the world, and mindfulness is just putting us there in the moment by moment wildness. It's very wild. It's all changing. It's wild life, actually. It's bringing us into wild life and not into the commenting mind that is stepping above life and saying, well, this, I know, making comments and decisions and distancing ourselves from wild life. So it reconnects ourselves with the moment by moment life. Instead of, for example, being in our patterns, tavniot, such as judgment. Judgment is a sort of pattern. If we give it space, it will come more and more. We go round and round with judgment, bikoritiyut. It just goes round and round, and it's a pattern. So it's a construction in us. It's not us. It's a construction that, like a kartsia, that just stuck inside for various reasons and goes round and round. And our task, it's good, absolutely. And if it, because we it gets so big that it becomes us. We identify, it becomes us because we don't see it. It just is operating inside us in an automatic way, and it makes our life miserable and makes other people miserable, and we don't see it. It's a construction inside us, but it's not us. The minute we can look at it and say, oh, judgment, here it is. Oh, here's a judgment thought. Oh, here it is again. Oh, here it is again, because it keeps coming. Someone once said, how to deal with judgment is count the number of judgmental thoughts you have, and when you get to 1,000 you'll be cured. But it's to once we can use mindfulness to watch the constructions that arrive through habit and conditioning, hatnaya, inside us, we then become a bigger container than these patterns and more free. It doesn't need censorship. And just, you know, again, what we were talking just now, it doesn't need someone inside to say, oh, I mustn't have these thoughts of judgment. That's another judgment, of course. So we're still in the same soup as before. Instead of that, all we need to do is recognize, oh, here's a judgmental thought, not very helpful, bye-bye. Oh, here it comes again, not very helpful, bye-bye. Here it comes again, hello, bye-bye. I don't know whether anyone's ever read to you the poem by Rumi called The Guest House. Anyone read it to you? Yeah? I hope I brought it. Actually, I might not have brought it. I just... Esther, maybe, yeah. It's the most classic poem in that everyone uses it in the Dharma community because it's kind of so expressive. But I don't think I have it. Don't know where it. I thought I brought it, but I don't know. Maybe I didn't. Never mind. It just basically says this human being is like a guest house. And any guest that knocks on the door, we open the door, we welcome them, we invite them in. And even guests that we don't like, that come in and make a mess of our furniture, of our house, that upset everything, we invite them in, we welcome them as a guest, and then we say goodbye when they leave. And it's like this sense of being a bigger than the guests, such as judgmental mind, that come into our being through habit and conditioning and all the voices we've internalized from year zero. We are bigger than them. And the only way we can be bigger than them, or one of the ways we can be bigger than them, is to see them. Oh, here's a guest, judgmental mind. Hello, how are you? Bye-bye. Oh, here's a guest. Anger. Here's another guest. Conflict.
So we need a doorman.
A doorman? Well, we probably, yeah. I'm not sure that we do, yeah. It's like... They're coming in anyway, but yes. It's true, but you know, in the mindfulness doesn't really distinguish the two. It's helpful for us to, for some pajana, to say what is healthy for us. This is not particularly healthy guest, but actually we don't exclude anybody. Healthy, unhealthy, it's all coming in, and we open the door to everybody. So there's, we don't, for example, say, and many people make this mistake, oh, the whole of mindfulness is about some kind of self-therapy, and I'm only going to pay attention to the difficulty. No, we also pay attention to the joy. The joy comes, open the door, welcome joy, hello, bye-bye. Not get stuck in the joy, and not get stuck on trying to attack judgment or any other negative state. Welcome them all in, but knowing that with wisdom that I did something active in order to reduce the pahad kahal that I had before. I recognized it was not healthy, and I was specifically intending practice to reduce it. So this is using the practice not as sort of neutral, but to actually say, no, let's work with this. And same with someone, for example, with anger, who would say, look, my anger is a real problem. It's giving problem to me and to others. Mindfulness applied to anger is, I will work with it. This guest needs special attention. I'm going to see his face. I'm going to invite him in. I'm going to understand him, see this demon. And I will then welcome him, watch him, and say goodbye. But the same with joy, the same with everything. There's a very nice English word, respect. We do need to respect everything that we see, because it's our life. But respect, I think, works better than the Hebrew, in this case, kavod. Kavod is a bit kaved, it's a bit heavy. A respect comes from Latin, meaning re is again, and spec is to see. So respect is to see again, to see again, to have a second look. And we have a second look, we respect, we give kavod, we give honor, we give. But it needs looking. So it's also not just stuff. We need to give importance and significance to things. And mostly what we do in our life is saying, we don't need to worry about this. That's okay. So the only thing left to worry about is my work or my relationships. So we turn off, we forget, we turn off big territories of our life, and we don't respect small things like breathing, walking, feeling. If they're not, if our head doesn't hurt, we don't know we've got a head. We forget that we've got a head until we have a headache. Then we have a headache. Then we say, oh, my head. Take Akamol. And then we can forget it again. Because of the Akamol. But it's opening a bigger territory of our lived experience. And for this, we also don't select. It's in a way what your question about the gatekeeper. We really don't select the rose and say we don't want the thorns, only the rose. The rose, the varied, is lovely, but it's got thorns, I don't like them. We kind of accept, you know, whatever's coming in is coming in. It's a non-selection, non-censorship. You want to ask something?
Is it equanimity?
It's more like equanimity is when we take that further in a certain direction to be really, it is in that direction, but it's more like just non-selective. Just not to be selective. Not to sort the world into, I only want these kind of experiences, I only want those kind of experiences. There's a very nice Theravada poem that says, I'm too hot, I'm too cold. That's the way that practice stops. Instead, I'm too hot, I'm too cold. These can be like the wild plants that we pass through as we walk. And then we find ourselves under a palm tree and just sit down. So, you know, journey, I'm too hot, I'm too cold. They're just a Zen phrase that says when the Buddha was too hot, he just sweated. When he was cold, he just shivered. So a student asked the Zen master, yes, but I do that. When I'm hot, I sweat, and when I'm cold, I shiver. But the Zen master said, you forgot the word just. When I'm too hot, I just sweat. In other words, right there with the phenomena as it happens. Okay, so one last thing, a general thing, before I go into the foundations themselves. As we develop mindfulness, we learn to open the hidden, the more subtle, below the radar, the things that we normally ignore. And we did it very clearly with the walking meditation. Just how many times do we really know that we walk? We're usually walking for some purpose, walking to the shop to buy something, walking to the car because we, in our mind, we have a job to do. And the walking itself is below the radar. So part of the opening ordinary life to bring back magic into the ordinary life is to open again more and more the subtle, ha'adin, the delicate, to see again the life process. Trushot, just flowing. It's not dramatic, it's not something we need to, in order to go to work, but if we are in touch with the basic elements of life, so we're in touch with life. There is a Sufi story, nice little story, about a man in prison, and he wrote to his friend saying, please send me a gun or a hammer, I want to break the lock and get out of this prison. So after a while he got a parcel, and in the parcel there was no gun and no hammer, there was just a prayer carpet, because he was Muslim, so it was just a carpet for prayer. So he was very angry. He threw the carpet in the corner of his cell, ta, and was angry for a couple of weeks. And then he said, well, I've got a carpet, I might as well start to pray. So he started to pray every day, and pray every day, five times a day, to pray on the carpet. After a few weeks, one day, his face was very close to the carpet as he was praying, and his face was here, and he looked for the first time at really what the pattern in the carpet, and all of a sudden he found that the pattern in the carpet, woven into the carpet, was the design of the lock on the door, and so he could open the lock and get out. So I think this is a good example. Our freedom comes from the subtle, looking at the pattern of the way things are, not the hammer that I want to be free, I want to be free, break it, you know. That's the same, that's the usual mind that uses a hammer. That so the Satipatthana Sutta says, someone wants to practice mindfulness, they go sit under a tree and bring their attention here, says, in front of them, or here, in other words, not there, not there, not some other place, not far away, not where I was, not my childhood, here. And the first foundation is the body, and the body, it says, be mindful of the bodiness of the body. It says, of body in body, which is quite an interesting way of describing. Be mindful of the body in the body. So it doesn't mean thoughts about the body. It doesn't mean what I want my body to be. It doesn't mean commenting about my body. My body's a sick body. It's an old body. It's a young body. It's not a good body, should be better body, should be prettier body, it should be more this body, that body. It's the bodiness of the body, the gufaniyut shel haguf. And so it's the lived experience beyond labels. There is no labeling in this. In mindfulness, no labeling. You don't need to put any comment on it. And it's not about the body in use. It's not about how I want to use my body. It's the intimacy with it. Yesterday, we have a small group in Clil, and someone joined us who has been with us for a couple of years, but he just had a period in hospital where they were replacing his moach etzem, is that? Meach etzem. And he was shut in a hospital room for 1 month without any entertainment, without any diversion, without any nothing. He was like closed in because of immunity he said the Dharma helped him hugely. Firstly, he really contemplated how all these tubes, sakiot, food going in, liquids going in, pee-pee going out, these drugs going in, drugs going out. He was in the middle of a chain of in and out. And he said, "Where is my body? Where is me? This sakit of liquid. So it's not me there, but it's me when it comes here, and then it's not me again when it goes out. So where is me actually? I'm just part of the tubes. I'm a middle piece of the tubes. I'm just in the middle, and there's a tube in, out, in, out." And he said he used mindfulness to reduce the fear just by watching and feeling his impressions, his sensations, and also when fear came, the treatment might not work or whatever. And he said there was a few days when all he did is watch the sun shining through the window onto a small patch of the wall opposite his bed. And he said this light of the sun on the wall put me into ecstasy, and for 3 days I was so high I thought I would fly out of the ceiling. I was in such ecstasy just watching this light of the sun shining on the wall. And it reminds us how we actually don't need so much to be joyful and to be fully alive, but we just need to notice the sun on the wall, the walking of the feet, the intimacy. I once met a monk from Cambodia who was 101 years old. And I asked him, how you managed to get to an age, this age? He said, "I do my practice every morning, and that keeps me alive. I said, "What's your practice?" He said, "I just go through the body, and I check each part of my body. Right ear, Ozen Yamin, how are you? I'm fine. Left ear, how are you? I'm fine. Hair of the head, how are you? I'm fine. Nose, how are you?" Go through the body bit by bit by bit by bit, checking each part in communication with each bit. That's my practice. Which is, by the way, quite a classical practice of mindfulness. You might have done it yourselves, which is just going through the body part by part. Maybe we'll do it today when we lie down. It's a nice exercise to do when we lie down. But it's just, that's it. It seems ridiculous, but that's it. This sense of intimacy with what is, rather than all our stories about what is. So the body is the first foundation, and body for us becomes a window rather than some project to have to do something with. It becomes a window, and it's the easiest first place to be mindful. It's easy. It's always there, it's got sensations, the touch with the ground as we did, it's very clear. It's the easiest place to be mindful. And as we are mindful, we open the body, discover more and more and more and more of the lived experience of the body. And as we do that, things happen to us. We learn quietness, we learn appreciation, we learn freedom, we learn something about the universe. The body has also got all these non-body elements, gravitation, solidity, hayosodot, that's all in the body. We learn, it expands, it's not just the body, it's also matzigeta yikum. The body is representing the universe for us. To be embodied in a body, right? To be dropped in a body. It represents the universe. One of my pleasures in life these days is at 4:30 in the morning, I go to my daughter, she lives next door. I told you all my three daughters came back to live in Klil with their children and their husbands. So they all live around us. 4:30 in the morning, I go, there's a new baby, she's 3 months. I go and I take the baby and I walk, do walking meditation with the baby, where my daughter can sleep extra couple of hours. Just walking up and down, and the baby does her, because they're grepsim and all the bubbles and the digestive digestive issues, and she complains a bit and then she's sleeping and then she complains. And I'm walking with the baby. And I really feel that we both of us in this arrived in this universe, we both just embodied in this universe. Who can say why, what, for what? Just something the second base or foundation of mindfulness is feelings. Liking, disliking, I want, I don't want, I need, I don't need, this is good for me, this is bad for me, this is hot, this is cold, this is too hot, this is too cold. And it's really an important practice that we are bigger also than that. That we, as long as, if we watch good for me, bad for me, then we're not in the automat of trying to make our life better, this become more comfortable. Remember, the Buddha left the castle of comfort. We don't want to build our own comfort castle, which is a prison. It's a prison. That all our life, we spend our whole life busy trying to be more comfortable. And that means all the investment, all the time, all the work, all the focus of the mind is based on what I need to be more comfortable. I need to feel better. And then we're back closed in the Buddha's castle, which is a prison. Actually, in a way, it's also Gan Eden. We were thrown out of Gan Eden, Girush mi Gan Eden, because now, you know, what is the tree of Tov Li Ra Li? Ze Ha'etz Tov Ra, Ze Tov Li Ra Li. It's a lot of Tov Ra, it's a lot of abstract, Mashu abstracti, Tov Ra, Ma Ze Tov Ra. Ze Tov Li Ra Li, Ze Isuk, that's what I'm busy with, Tov Li Ra Li, Tov Li Ra Li. So instead of that, we choose Tree of Life, Etz Chaim, which has in it, so yeah, noach li lefamim, koev li lefamim, lo noach li, okay. Tchushot shel nimot, pleasant sensations, tchushot lo nimot, unpleasant sensations, that's all it is. That mindfulness, you can see how much that can free us, rather than being busy all our life with trying to be more comfortable, trying to reduce the rali and increase the tovli. And this is really where there's a big difference between a painful experience and suffering. If we come down off the suffering, hasevel, and we just have a painful experience, and this is painful, I recognize that I'm mindfully aware of painful experience, mindfully aware of a pleasant experience, and then we are not sufferers, hasovel. We don't build. Mindfulness really helps us to reduce suffering directly by being able to have unpleasant sensation or pleasant sensation and not build anything, because mindfulness is just awareness of itself. And the Buddha said again, like body in the body, he said, feeling in feeling. Feeling inside feeling. Not, I don't want these feelings, but what is happening in this feeling? A bit like the example I gave of feelings of fear that I experienced in front of the kahal of students, especially British students, very bikoriti. I want to read to you a quote from Krishnamurti. And it's a challenging quotation. And this part, the second foundation, is challenging for us because we can hardly help. It's very strong. If we go to the Rofe Shinayim, who is going to say, I'll be with the sensations of the unpleasant sensations. You don't need to give me an injection. Who will do that? So it's challenging. And when feelings become emotion, they become much stronger, because there is not only feeling of like, not like, there is also the body included, there is thought included, there is the heart pain included. It becomes a very big package. And then it's much stronger because it's got all these elements. Still, our practice is the farek, to look at, for example, anger. If you want to say how to tapel with my anger, same way, mindfully looking at what is really happening at the level of present moment experience of anger. And then you'll see heart beating, gyus of heat, memories coming, bah. You have a lot of stuff coming, but you just watch that as a pasifas, as elements, which altogether, when we don't think about it, becomes anger, automatic, bah, anger. That's all collected together as a feeling without any mindfulness. As soon as we are mindful, we open this experience of anger. It's just painful sensations, body sensations, mental memories, etc. So I'll quote you Krishnamurti here. Every thought and feeling must flower for them to live and to die. Flowering of everything in you, the ambition, the greed, the hate, the joy, the passion. And in the flowering, there is their death and freedom. To allow envy is kin'ah, to flower is not easy. Everyone condemns it, or everyone holds on to it, but never gives it freedom. It's only in freedom that the fact of envy shows its color, its shape, its depth, its character. If suppressed, denied, it will not reveal itself fully and freely. When it has shown itself completely, there is an ending of it, just to reveal another fact: emptiness, loneliness, fear, underneath the envy. And as each fact is allowed to flower in freedom completely, the conflict between the observer and the observed is ended. There is no longer a censor, but only observation, only seeing. Freedom can only be in completion, in finishing, not in repetition, suppression, denial of a pattern of thought. Completion is letting it flower and letting it die. So it's expressing very beautifully this sense of not being a censor. Even the most difficult things in our life, letting them flower, providing we are able to be a container, to be watchful and mindful. And that's why we do and sit and work on breath. It's to be a bigger container. Once we can start practicing mindfulness with our breath, we can do it with anger. But if we don't start with the breath, it's hard to do it with anger. You can ask anybody, how do you do, you know, go and practice mindfulness with your anger. Anger just comes like a wind, like a tsunami. I can't practice mindfulness, much too strong. Of course it's too strong. But we practice with the breath so that then we can practice with anger. Because we already trained sharpening the mind, making our mind bigger and more able to contain, l'achil, the things that are stronger, like anger. The third... the third foundation is mind, citta. And here, again, the Buddha said, look at mind with mind. You think, oh, how can I look at my mind with my mind? But of course you can. Like the minute you say, my mind is dull, not clear. My mind is a tired mind. My mind is not quiet, isheket, or my mind is quiet, or anxious mind, etc. We are then looking at the mind with the mind. So this sense of being a witness, ed, edut, to be a witness to our mind, is a third foundation. And this morning, in the practice, we were actually following the foundations of mindfulness, and I invited you to, yes, to you, without needing a course of 10 days, and without needing weekend after weekend after weekend to learn mindfulness with the breath, you can look at the mind and say, my mind is calm, my mind is not calm, my mind is... We can do it, and why not? And we did it. Maybe some of you, or not. So, again, what's important when looking at the mind is not to identify with the mind, but to just say what's going on, to lo lizdahot aval lo zahot, to know what's going on, to be clear. Mindfulness is about being clear, to be aware of what's going on as phenomena passing by. Guest in the guest house. Here is a dull mind, here is an angry thought, here is a judgmental thought, here is judgmental mind coming. Hello, bye-bye. If we keep going with this, in the end we will see that all these are empty. And I'm not going to talk about emptiness now, because I'm sure that Raz has talked a lot about emptiness. It's very much the subject. But you can see how, if we welcome these guests in a very practical way, welcome this guest called judgmental mind, if we keep doing it, we see how empty this thing is that before we thought was so powerful and strong and controlling us as a shed. Is like a shed called judgmental mind. But as soon as we look at him, he's not a shed anymore. He comes in, he comes out, he's a guest. Actually, as Rilke said, he's just a princess that needs our love, this demon. Empty phenomena coming in and going out, passing away. That's all they are. And we gave so much importance to them that they feel so solid, so strong, so in control of us. The more we see, they're just mental phenomena passing, empty. The fourth foundation is the story that we tell ourselves. Who are we? What is the story going on? It's sometimes translated as mental content, tochen. It's actually what is the messages that we're getting. And mostly when we look at our mind, we just feel that this is a crazy mess of stories jumping about like a chargol, like a grasshopper, mostly dumb thoughts that have no importance. And also we can't stop them, completely out of control mind. And we think, whoa, that's me? I mean, sure, all of you must have had this experience when sitting watching the mind. This mess, that's me? How did that happen? It makes no sense, one after another. It's all stupid thoughts, the jumping about, and I can't stop them. And they're in control of me, I'm not in control of them. I can't control them. I can't control my thoughts and so on. And it would be a joke, except it's also a terrible tragedy. Because it's just this mental content that makes people go out and kill each other. That they have a view, like the Jews are contaminating the German race, so we have to get rid of them. Or I don't know what. We're frightened of the Vietnamese, so we have to bomb the other side of the world. We have to bomb Vietnamese peasants, like the Americans, in the name of freedom. So we kill a few million Vietnamese people in the name of freedom. That's the Americans kept saying, freedom, 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 in the name of freedom, kill a few million Vietnamese. I mean, you can see what the way the mind, the tragedy that the mind creates from its views and its content, creating so much suffering and death and wars. And if we just watch, we can watch the mental content. The Buddha said again, watch the content as content, watch the story as story. We need a story, okay, here's a story. Watch the story come and go. And we realize that our mind is kind of a mirror, or like a kind of tzalachat for the picks-up television. The mind itself is empty. It picks up stories as it goes along, and then it makes these stories holy. But the mind itself is empty. It's just, there's nothing there. It fills itself, and then we forget that it's empty. So the more we understand that we are, all the stories are sitting in an empty mind, the more we can actually, part of what we're doing is being mindful of empty mind, which is like the mirror, the mar'ah, or the tzalachat, or the antenna, the mechushim. And slowly, 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 by this kind of awareness, the fourth foundation is where our brain changes. Where through this direct understanding, again and again watching mind and being in a way at peace with the story and beyond the story, we open more, for example, right brain, as opposed to left brain, we have more balance between right brain, left brain. We have a more global view, we have more presence that is beyond the story, awareness by itself. That's why the fourth foundation is called Dharma. Dharma. So if you look in the text, you'll get the text, then it's the fourth foundation is Dharma. And what happens is...
The fourth.
It's called Dharma because there is where the truth begins to take over. That it's the fourth foundation is where we're more interested in the truth and into the in the insight. And there's something very important that is in the Buddha's teaching that you may not have met this, but it's key. Awakening doesn't happen because of a sort of accident that suddenly you're walking along your ordinary self and suddenly you get Barak Milamala and you're awakened. Awakening happens because your brain, your mind and your consciousness begins to be to have qualities which are different from ordinary mind. Qualities. These qualities include, for example, quality of mindfulness as you go about your life, a quality of calmness, a quality of equanimity. Do you know the word equanimity?
No.
It's ishtavut, a quality of love. Universal love, love just for the sake of love, undirected, unconditioned love, a quality of energy and vitality, a quality of determination, of to keep going, the chishut, and quality of wisdom, understanding, for example, emptiness. Understanding the way things change and flow, understanding things about pain and difficulty. So this sort of depth of understanding or insight. These qualities are the changes that happen to us as we practice spiritually. And from these qualities, awakening comes. Or through these qualities, awakening comes. So the qualities are developing like a kind of the cooking the meal. And laying the table, and then our life gets to become a more awakened life because of qualities, not just because we're waiting for a barak to hit us of called enlightenment. We're building qualities in our life, and these are some of the qualities, and this is the fourth foundation, is mindfulness of these qualities, developing these qualities. So in a small way, for example, we may feel the quality of energy in me is less now. Now the quality of energy is right, in harmony, be'izun, not isheket and not sleep, or atzlanut or passiviut. The dugma, this is an example. Between passiviut and activiut, or isheket, sheket. Energy is a big field of energy. To develop right energy is, for example, one of the qualities that brings us to awakening. You see these great teachers who are just giving Dharma from morning to night, 12 hours a day, to hundreds and hundreds of people. You go to monasteries in Burma and you see these great teachers non-stop, 15 hours a day. Because the energy is right, so they can just keep going. So I'll finish more or less with this.
Can I ask a question?
In just 1 second, I just want to finish the... I think that will do. I've talked enough and that's fine. Yeah, I'm happy to have a question.
I'm not sure I understand the difference between the third and the fourth foundation. They sound like aspects of the mind.
Yeah, they're not really very clearly demarcated. And the truth is that we ourselves experience the foundations are not completely cut and distinct and from each other, but the third foundation is just looking at mind, at the state of my mind, whereas the fourth foundation is looking at the content of the mind. What's my mind actually saying to me? What qualities of messages? What are the kind of messages that are happening in my mind? What kind of truth is appearing in the mind, rather than states of mind like tiredness, wellness, anger, anxiety, and so on? It's like,
aren't these the feelings? Aren't these the second?
Yeah, but they cross over, because the second is more directly I like, I don't like.
So,
but when it's
judgment.
Second is feelings of liking, not liking. The third is that together with mind, meaning emotions, and anxiety would be between second and third. Emotions would tend to be between second and third because they need body and they need mind. So they would tend to bridge second and third. So I don't think we should don't get too caught up in the trying to separate them, but that's the sort of general. You can read it when you get the text, and you can see that's the general. General sense that the second is direct liking, not liking, and the third is mind, states of mind, and emotion will be between the second and the third, and story will be to some extent between the third and the fourth. And when you really have insight, it's really right in the fourth. And when you keep practicing, then in a way the mind only is interested in Dharma. And then it's entirely in the fourth. You're only interested in, the mind only has in it messages, story, to do with Dharma, to do with the way, the path, and the. So then it's really inside the fourth.
To ask if it can be applied also to meditation, if this is what you meant about
very much
lezahot velo lizdot, about greeting and saying goodbye, and in the middle questioning a little bit about
exactly
guess, so it's the same thing
exactly
also
I mean meditation is a mindfulness is kind of. It's not exactly the same as meditation, because it's a big complicated story. Meditation really is a much bigger world than just mindfulness, but they've come to mean the same in the Western context. There's a cultural thing here. So for the moment you can say mindfulness is the same as meditation of this, the kind we're doing. But when you, especially when you're doing mindfulness Vipassana, meaning working with content. Deep concentration is not really mindfulness. It's different. It's still meditation. So I don't really want to go into. We can discuss this more later on, but my sense is mindfulness is about being aware, having a bigger mind to what's really happening to us. It's very helpful, by the way, for householders, for people in the community, for people living ordinary life who are not monks. The monks often go in another direction, which is jhana. Jhana, dhyana, like I said before, became Zen. Jhana is deep concentration, where you're so concentrated you basically absorbed totally in an object. So for example, very simply, if you have a candle and you're really absorbed into the candle, you're actually not mindful. It's actually concentration. It also does something. It makes one-pointed mind, like a really strong, sharp, one-pointed mind, instead of all the pizur, the scattering. So it's a very sharp mind, but it's not mindfulness. So it's concentration is not mindfulness, but they're both under the category of meditation. So what I'm saying now, yes, you're absolutely right. The guest house is mindfulness. I thought I brought it with me, the guest house, such a nice poem, but I just can't find it. I put it in my bag. Maybe it's still in my bag now. Yeah, sure.
You mentioned concentration and you mentioned mindfulness as two separate things. Now there is this aspect of meditation that I find very useful in therapy, and this is this thing of letting go. When you see a thought and you, there are different metaphors to put it, on a leaf, on a river, or a balloon that goes, but this action of dropping, of letting go.
Absolutely.
Where does that fit in the, because it's not the same as being mindful. Being mindful is staying with it, and then after comes the letting go. Or what's the relationship between concentration, letting go, and mindfulness?
Yeah, it's a very nice question. Mindfulness, the truth is that mindfulness, which is simply the application of attention and awareness, will show you that everything goes by itself. And actually you don't have to work hard to let go, because the mindfulness shows you that things go anyway. You cannot hold on to things, because if you really look at them as they are, they go. Our mind, the non-aware mind, gets stuck. But the aware mind will show you that everything is by itself passing away. The strongest, it's amazing in retreats, the strongest patterns that people have, and the obsessions, and it goes round and round and round and round, and the minute the bell rings, it's gone. The strongest, most painful pattern, the bell rings for lunch, whew, didn't exist. What pattern was it? I don't know. So it's kind of things go by themselves, and if you look carefully, you really only see the back of things. You actually don't actually see. One, the father of the last century of the Vipassana style practice, I would say the renewal of ancient Buddhist practice into the modern world, is Achan Chah, who's a major teacher in the Thai tradition. And he said, every thought or impression comes in and wants to sit down inside you, but there's only one seat and you're sitting on it. It's lovely. And another one of those that I heard, these one-liners that I heard just last week, a teacher said, if you check it out, it checks out. You know how you say check out in a hotel? You check out your bags, you leave the hotel. So if you check it out, it checks out. In other words, if you check something out, you see it goes anyway. You don't actually have to do censorship work so hard. If you watch judgment, it comes and it goes by itself. That's the power of meditation, of this practice. You're not manipulating anymore, having to sort out all the patterns, and this is not good for them, blah, 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 try and make surgery in the mind, you know, nituach, and this. It's like you see things go by themselves. And the strongest pattern, if you look carefully, there's an empty mind with things coming in, things going out. And they might feel stuck, but that's because we've given them the power to hold us, to control us. We've given the power to the Shedim. But if you look at the in the Gova Einayim, straight eye, everything is coming in, going out. Actually, I think I have in my bag, I think I might have the guest house, and it's such a nice poem, I would like to read it. Here we are. Being human is like a guest house. Each morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, an anger. Some temporary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. Respect. Treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the rage. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond.